good afternoon. We're going to begin straight away because I understand documents are still being copied. We do need, of course, to complete the BRR before 5:15. So we're in lots of, what's the word? We have a lot of pressures on us. But we would like to welcome the Minister, Dr. Rob Davies of Trade and Industry, and the, I always have to see if the DG is here, and then I can go to the DG, to the Deputy Ministers here, though, I see. Mr. Elizabeth Tabetha is there. So she's also very welcome, and other members, of course, from the department. Essentially, of course, members from the handling the Companies Amendments Bill itself, the DDG, Zordwe and Thule, and her team. So this is what I propose to do. We actually should have looked at the BRR, RRR first to comply with deadlines, but it isn't ready, the copies. So please can we immediately shift to what is, I think you're all aware that the company's bill was tabled, amendment bill, and the minister has agreed to be here for a briefing on this amendment bill, which will then, of course, has been advertised for the public hearings to begin on the 30th of November. So, Minister, we're going to hand over to yourself and your team, please.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Chairperson. Chair, the presentation on what's in this bill will come from the team here, from the Deputy Director General. I just want to say a few introductory words about what this bill is about. This bill is in formal terms known as the Companies Amendment Bill, but we call it, in terms of our own working title, the Companies Rectification Bill. And what this is about is it's about basically making a few amendments to the Companies Bill so that we can implement it in the due date of the end of the first quarter of next year. That's the intention. And essentially what happened was that in the course of preparing the regulations, and given that this is a rather major piece of legislation, you know, this is my file of it, this is it, it's a kind of a, it's a phone book of a bill. And given that, I think, and given its newness, it's not surprising that there were a number of errors and omissions and things that I think ended up being rather small technical matters, but were more than a comma and a full stop and things of that sort. So that's what this bill is about. It's essentially to correct a few things. I'm not going to go through the details of it, but I'll just mention one. Which is one of the first ones you'll come across, is domestication of foreign companies. Now, what happened basically was that under the existing Companies Act, there are certain provisions about companies which have been registered abroad and now want to domesticate back to South Africa, and they were just simply not covered in the bill, and it was not that there was an intention not to cover them and hence not to allow domestication to take place. So this has been incorporated into this bill. And there are other things of that sort. There are a couple of matters about conversion of par value shares. This was a matter of a lot of debate, a lot of discussion. And this is just simply that the new proposals in terms of the new principles that govern this bill around basically the requirements of maintaining solvency and liquidity mean that a methodology of having shares, certain kinds of preference shares, valued at their par value, is no longer compatible with the principles, and therefore a process of this is envisaged to take place. And then, in consultation with National Treasury, they said, "Well, there's a big issue here around possible tax avoidance," and so we've incorporated a few provisions of that sort in. So I think it's nothing that is outside of the fundamental principles and framework of the company's legislation that was passed in 2008. I believe that piece of legislation is a very, very important piece of reform We haven't had a major restructuring of our company law. We've had lots and lots of amendments since 1973. It is a very complex, very diverse piece of legislation, the existing Companies Act, with all the amendments that have been made. What does the new Act does is it considerably simplifies it. It will reduce very, very significantly the regulatory burden. The registration procedures in this bill will be very simple and straightforward. All these things, memorandums, articles of association, all of the complex things that are difficult now for small businesses to register except under the closed corporations, these will disappear. There will be no more need for companies to go and buy shelf companies from somebody else because the procedures are long and complicated. There are things like the financial statements do not have to be audited below a threshold. There are things like a business rescue scheme, which I think is a major piece of innovation, which means that no longer are we talking about if a company starts to have some liquidity or financial troubles, what happens? It goes to judicial management, and that is a route basically to bankruptcy. This is a real possibility of rescuing companies in those positions. So I think that the piece of legislation, the main piece of legislation, is going to be, I think, without doubt, of major importance to business in this country. It was, among other things, our African Peer Review Mechanism report called for this, actually. I think we should just take note of that. Called for this, for us to reform this. And I think that this piece of legislation is in place. In order for us to get it implemented by the time frame, not only do we have to pass the regulations, which that work is pretty much complete by and large, but we also have to pass this rectification bill. I think that if we look at it in that spirit, then I think we should be able to, hopefully, in a fairly disciplined way, process this bill, deal with the issues that are raised there. I have no doubt that there will be all kinds of people that want to reopen issues that were settled in the passage of the main bill that will probably come here and make presentations and so on. But I think we would urge the committee to look at the intention of this bill and expedite actually the implementation of a piece of legislation, as I say, which I have no doubt will be a very significant step forward for business regulation in this country. So I think with those few words of introduction, let me hand over to the team who will go in more detail through the seven or eight amendments which we are proposing. Just one last point. Let me just say that the team that drafted this was a team of very, very serious experts. It was led by Judge Dennis Davies as our team, our internal team on this. So I think it gives you some idea of the caliber of people that look through this this legislation. So there we are. So let me just hand back to you, or hand over to the DDG with your permission, Chair.
Do go ahead, DDG.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. I think the Minister says good morning. Good afternoon. We always used to be at 9 o'clock. thanks a lot for the opportunity again to present in front of this committee. I think Minister has summed up the key issues and the rationale for us being here. And I have a team, as usual, here. McDonald's McTenzie, I've got Rory Fowler, and I've got Flip Dwenger and Desmond Zamabulena. This is a team that has been working on this, and is a team that has worked with the experts that were assisting us in this matter. And as the Minister has said, this team was led by Judge Dennis Davis in trying to rectify that. The presentation will outline, you know, the following areas, and we're not going to dwell on most of those issues in detail, but I think if there are questions on some of the issues, we may expand on them, because I think the Minister has covered some of the key principles that we are introducing with this particular rectification process. We'll cover some of those key areas. There may be other smaller amendments that you will see in the bill that is in front of you. But most of those would be like your consequential amendments, cross-referencing, because of introduction of largely the inclusion of the domestication provisions. So that has impacted on a number of other provisions. So you will see that there's the minor amendments that would be in the bill and that will make the bill look longer than actually it is in terms of what we're trying to bring in. Minister has covered that during the regulations process. Obviously, we pick up, as you go in detail through the legislation, that there are some errors. And again, we've indicated that the errors that we picked up are errors largely that were grammatical, cross-referencing, and all of that. But over and above that, there's also areas where we picked up some inconsistencies, where one provision was amended during the processing of the bill in Parliament, but then the other sections that are linked to that particular provision were not referenced correctly to refer to the now revised provision. So you'll see that some of the things are really correcting that area to create that consistency. But some of the other areas is areas where, for instance, the reading of the provision gives a number of interpretations such that it is not clear what exactly is meant. So we found that there may be a disconnect between what the policy intention was and what is currently in the legislation. So we don't want to subject the legislation to a whole lot of misinterpretation or the court then deciding it, you know, different from what the policy intention was. So where we observe that there may be the risk of that, we think that it is better to come back to Parliament and say, this is what we pick up, so that we can at least avoid a situation where it becomes difficult to implement the legislation which we want to actually achieve those objectives that we wanted to achieve in the policy. So we've covered the process, and I'm not going to go through that, but just to mention to the committee that we have circulated the document, which is the scope of this rectification process. What we did was to publish the scope for the rectification process and invited stakeholders to tell us if they are picking up any errors in the legislation and forward those to us. And the scope was very clear in terms of what are the issues that we're looking at and what type of errors are we looking at. And so the process then, after the submissions of those written comments from stakeholders, was then to focus on those submissions and analyze the comments that we've received and determine whether they fall within the scope. Because one of the things that was clear from the onset in terms of this process was that we're not opening any policy debates on the issues that were closed by this Parliament, but to say that we wish to rectify some of the things that we think that might make this legislation perhaps in some instances being misinterpreted and disconnecting from the policy intention. We did receive a number of submissions, and we have also circulated a list of the stakeholders to the committee members. I hope all of us have that. But also what we've done for you is to circulate the process document that basically, you know, outlined the steps that we took in this reform process from the beginning when we were doing the corporate law reform on its own. And we're mapping out the process from that beginning to up to date, you know, where we are today, just so that you have a sense of what we've been engaged in. And if there are any questions in regards to that process and the consultation in that process, then we'll also be available to respond to those. I've covered the slides, so I'm going to pass some of the slides because I think Minister has covered some of those things. But I think it is important for us, and purely for the purposes that this committee, some of the members were not in this committee when this bill was processed, just to give an overview of the reason why we needed to reform the company law regime in South Africa. It is without doubt, it was very outdated. It's 1973. I was 2 years old when it was passed. So. Yes, there has been a number of amendments to it, and I think with the latest, the Corporate Law Amendment Act, which we found, again, difficult also to implement because of the major disconnect. You know, we tried to amend on a piecemeal basis, but I think a whole lot of things have changed, you know, in how companies are run, in how directors' responsibilities are catered for in pieces of legislation, what is obligatory, what is voluntary, and all of those things. The world has changed so much, and we didn't have a legislation that aligns to those changes. For instance, I'll give you an example that when the legislation relating to BEE was introduced, there was a whole lot of things that were so impractical if you look at them in the company's legislation, it was difficult such that you could not implement some of the things that you want to implement in the BEE. For instance, the issues of buying shares in a company, like a company loaning a person money to buy its shares. That was not practical under the 1973 Act. But similarly, the issue around the issuing of prospectus and all of that. And so if you recall some of the BEE transactions that have occurred in the country, there were some limitations, and some of them were actually subject to some litigation, although it didn't go that far. But you find that if you were to interpret the legislation technically, some of the things that were happening under that would actually not be possible in terms of the 1973 Act. And the Sasol shares, for instance, I mean, there was an issue around the issue of prospectus, the advertising of it and all of that, which is contrary to what our 1973 was saying. So there are a number of things that were so backdated in the 1973 Act that were not aligned to where, you know, the world is going. And those are some of the things that necessitated that we need to update our legislation and do an overhaul of that. So this is not just little amendments, it was the overhaul of the entire system. And also just the number of scandals, you know, relating to non-adherence to corporate governance and all of that have also made it a necessity for us to have a regime that will govern that area appropriately. And you'll see that in this act that has been signed into law by the president in 2008, we have codified some of the principles of corporate governance, which in most instances were things that were nice to do for companies, but now are obligatory because of the experiences over the years of where companies basically go under as a result of just lack of adherence to corporate governance. And then I think the one thing that is also important, Minister touched on it, is really the easing of regulatory burden. And I think the Companies Act is not the only act that requires that kind of assessment. And I think there should be a bigger process of looking at each and every piece of legislation and see if it's actually necessary. Because if we've got some provisions in the legislation somewhere sitting there which is not necessary, then it adds to the compliance cost for companies, because they still have to comply with it, even if it's irrelevant or it does not, the reason for it doesn't exist anymore. So that's one of the reasons why the Companies Act had to be looked at, to say, are all these provisions actually still relevant? If they are not relevant, why are they still there? Because then you still, compel companies to comply with them, in fact, even if they're not. But also the registration processes in terms of companies and all of that, you find that we still have like a very sort of primitive way of approaching it. There's been development. And you look at the number of processes that you have to go through just to establish a company. It was something that was critical for us, because when we adjust as a country in terms of the ease of doing business, that's one of the considerations. So we had to focus particularly on that area. But one thing that is also important here is that we also needed to increase the levels of transparency in how the companies are run. And there are specific provisions that relate to companies that are required to observe an enhanced transparency policy, in a sense. So there's specific compliance requirements in regard to that, so that you don't impose provisions that are burdensome to smaller companies that don't need that. But then you need to distinguish the categories of companies and apply the relevant provisions against the risk that exists if that compliance requirement is not imposed. And the policy objective, just in summary, because I think as a background, this information would be useful to see where the company law reform that we put through this committee entailed. We needed to obviously repeal, like I said, this is a total overhaul, but also we need to simplify the registration processes, the maintenance of companies, but as well as making provision for the appropriate institution to deal with the registration process, but also the enforcement part of it, because the institutional framework in South Africa had serious gaps. And also we needed to look at some of the concepts within the 1973 Act and look at their relevance. Ministers covered the issue of the par value shares and why we had to look at it, and also that concept is being phased out. And again, it's purely because, our approach now is has moved from, looking at companies from a capital-based point of view, but we're looking now at issues around solvency, you know, the liquidity as opposed to just purely capital. So if we move towards that direction, you obviously would see that there's no need for having a system of past dilution, because it actually doesn't help anything. It just gives you a non-true situation or reflection of the value of the company and all of that. So there's no point in having it. So we've looked at that and looked at some of these things to say they don't only become a problem for people to understand, but they actually are a problem for enforcement agencies to deal with. And we also look at the issue of the enhancement of the protection of the minority shareholders. You'll see that in the New Companies Act, we've actually advanced that a bit, in a sense that a minority shareholder, if they're able to convince about 10% of the members, they could be in a position to compel a meeting to be held, which is something that has been difficult. If you're a minority shareholder, it's very difficult. You can ask for information, you don't get it, and you can't even call a meeting until maybe you have what you've probably convinced about more than 25% of the shareholders to call a meeting. So we've actually enhanced that to make sure that we protect the minorities sufficiently. And also the issues around the mergers and acquisitions, they are more clarified in the legislation, the specific obligations in there, but also just the linkages between the takeover regulation panel and the role of the New Companies Commission, the alignment of that and the separation and clear separation of what the mandates are is spelled out appropriately in the Act. The last thing that I just want to indicate is really the intention to decriminalize the legislation, because if you look at the 1973 Act, everything was an offense, you know, meaning that it's a criminal offense, and that whatever action that you need to take, it needs to follow the Criminal Procedures Act. So we had to look at some of the provisions that actually could be dealt with administratively and some of the things that could be dealt with through a criminal procedure process. So we've clearly distinguished those things, and we've outlined some of those things in the legislation. So that's one of the features that is very important for us to understand why we needed to have the reform itself. The following are the issues that we are dealing with today, just in terms of taking you through the bill itself. We'd look at the domestication issue. That is the domestication of foreign companies, the powers of the business rescue practitioner. Minister has already indicated that one of the key features of this legislation is that introduction of the business rescue provision, which is basically replacing the judicial management process, but also the intention is to try to prevent more companies from going under and just introduce a step that could quickly and effectively, perhaps more effectively, deal with the companies that are in distress. And in this case, it's important to distinguish between companies that are in financial distress and companies that are actually at the stage of insolvency, because the provision doesn't deal with companies that are now at the stage of insolvency. Those will be dealt with in terms of the insolvency law. And also the registration of external companies, that is dealt with in the current Section 23 of the Act. And we also deal with the independent review of financial statements. I think there we just need clarifying the distinction between an independent review and an audit, so that the intention is not missed, because there was a concern that could actually be misinterpreted, because in terms of the Audit Professions Act, an audit includes an independent review, but what was intended in the Companies Act is something that is very clear, that an independent review is a separate process, it's something different from an audit itself. And then we'll also look at some mechanism in terms of dealing with the practitioners, people that will then you know, perform this business rescue on companies. We're looking at the Act provides for who those people are going to be in terms of the criteria, the qualifications, and all of that. But there's some clarity that we need to also enhance there, because there were some reading of the provisions were not clear in some instances. And then the conversion of the pars erucias, but also in some areas, like for instance in terms of public offerings, we had to introduce a provision that would empower the minister to then do regulations that will guide the step that should be followed in that process. And then we also deal with the issue around void transactions, void and voidable provisions in the Act. I think that's Section 218 of the current Act. We just clarified something there again, which was resulting in some misinterpretation of the policy intention. And then the last one is really to look at some of the legislation that should take precedence over the Companies Act in case of conflict. That is dealt with in Section 5 of the Companies Act. So those are the areas that we'll touch on. But like I said, there are a number of other issues that we have amended there, but they're all linked to the main issues that we'll be dealing with here. And to the extent that there may be some that are not covered, are not linked here, we'll clarify those as we go along. Thanks. I'll just hand over to McDonald to just give in detail some of the areas, but I think we're not going to dwell too much into each one of them because I think the Minister has already in his summary covered, you know, the whole purpose and the rationale for some of these areas. Thanks.
No, thanks. Thanks, Chairperson, and the Minister, the Deputy Minister, and the Honourable Members of the House. It's difficult when the Minister has introduced things and the DDG, because virtually they have done their work. So just to pretend that I'm also working, I will also do some details. Today I want to talk about any sui generis issue. I'm talking company law. No, thanks. Domestication of foreign companies. Just by way of an example, there are companies who maybe per year we receive 10 or 20 who said, we want to migrate into your country. We want to be here. Please accept us. So it was a policy issue in the 1973 Act. When we formulated this policy, somehow, by omission, we chose to forget. And then probably there was going to be some xenophobic statements to say, we don't want companies to come into the country. So we are saying, please, forgive us, we are here. We don't like to have such a thing. Allow us to amend the legislation so that they can come in peace. So that's all what we are requesting here. So, yeah. Powers of business rescue. You know the judicial management that it never worked in South Africa. The court used to say, if a company is not working well, let's go for judicial management. And then you find that we were just sending that company to ICU and then death, no revival. So this issue of business rescue is introduced in our act. It has been debated as a policy issue. But now the powers of the business practitioner, somehow it was felt that he or she has got absolute powers. Can just say, I want to effect judicial management on you, even if it is not warranted, maybe, and then contract that to be cancelled. Absolutely. Although we debated, but we came to a conclusion to say, one, the business rescue practitioner does not have absolute powers, in so much his or her powers should be subjected to the powers of the court. In other words, after you have done whatever you want to do as a practitioner, you go to court, the court can say, yeah, you overstepped. I think that's what we are requesting here. However, there is only one contract that cannot be touched. That is the power, the employment contract. That one is sacrosanct. It cannot be touched, that one. The others, they can be tampered with, but the court has got a final say. I think that's all what we are requesting. registration of external companies, there were debates on Section 23. Some of us were saying, no, you can read it well. It does not disturb anything. Others said, but just to come and hold a meeting in South Africa, it means, therefore, I'm running a business. I need to be registered. Then, but the final conclusion was to say, no, let's clarify this issue. And then, however, if you start to be here in South Africa and you employ people, little by little, then we will say, I think now you are conducting business in South Africa. But outside that, the others are very minimal. You won't be disturbed, except that the commission will have a discretion to say, I see that you are doing something which is akin to conducting a business. Give me a reason why I should not force you to register. So there should be a reason. You know, we are a constitutional state. So that's all what we are requesting here. To say, let us clarify. The issue of independent review, the minister dwelt on that. I may do a mistake here, but only to emphasize that auditing in South Africa, in terms of the Auditing Profession Act, auditing includes independent review, in terms of the Auditing Profession Act. So therefore, when we came here in 2008, to say, let's separate the two processes. Audit, we know the definition of audit. Independent review, we know it. We forgot maybe to say, for the purposes of the Companies Act, independent review and audit are not the same. Audit is of a higher standard threshold. Independent is of a lower threshold. However, they are all internationally recognized. Nobody should come with an argument of saying, now you are reducing the standard, therefore in South Africa, corporate governance will go so low. No. It is, these two processes are recognized internationally. There is a threshold. Licensing of business rescue practitioners, what we are requesting is that the companies and the Intellectual Property Commission, we license those persons who are not subject to a regulated authority and ensure a simple and efficient process subject to vetting and approval is sought. Conversion of par value shares. What I can indicate here is that shares have got categories in the main. So par value shares per se, it means shares that have a nominal value or a sentimental value. Say family companies may say, I'm giving you 200 shares because you are part and parcel of the family, nominal value. Whereas shares, generally, they need to be valuated. To say MTN values are 20 rand today, tomorrow the market forces put them at 200 per share, as an example. So the issue of par value shares, it may have a problem when we are going to sell the company or to sell shares, because some of them do not have a market value. It's a nominal value. That is the distinction which we want. So therefore, the policy rationale was to say, let us deal away with the issue of par value shares onwards. However, with our sister department, we said, let's do it in the regulation in such a way that it should not trigger tax implications. There should be no tax implications. Because if there are tax implications, you may find that you depose those shares, the tax men, generally they are men, they come and say, you have now deposed an asset, and then later I said I didn't do anything, but you triggered a tax implication. So that's all what we are saying. Let's amend our legislation in so much that the two ministers later can do it in a form of regulation. That's all what we are seeking for here. Empowering the minister, it was said on the issue of public offerings, there should be regulations. Regulations are easier because they are at ministerial level. Although nowadays I know that we are called to cabinet or to parliament just to sensitize the political principles, but the minister is the person who has got an overall authority and can issue those in ease instead of coming to argue here in court, in parliament. Void and voidable, it's true that there were some contradictions, but just to simplify issues, void, it means therefore, from the first instance, this thing is not valid from the first instance. They call it void ab initio. From the first instance you kill it, it's void. Voidable, it means therefore, is debatable. The court can still say, yes, we think it's okay, or we think it's not okay. But void, let me give an example. A void is that the act cannot say, there are what we call statutory rape, as an example. 5-year-old baby, a girl is raped, that is a rape. There is no debate about that. But if you go to sometime 16.5 years old, 16.5 years or 17.5, the 18 year threshold, that minor enters into a contract. The court may debate with you later. It may say, yeah, we think that person appreciated and understood what is in the contract. Like at university, a minor of 17.5 years say, I will pay everything. They enter into that contract later. That minor says, no, the contract was void because I was a minor. So it may be debated to say, no, we think you could have appreciated this in the circumstances, and therefore you are okay. Then the issue of legislation taking precedent, the PFMA takes precedent, and other sections act there. But somehow the Municipality Finance Management Act, as an example, it is akin to the PFMA, as an example. It's not listed there. The rationale here is to say, the act which gives a higher threshold application, very strict, they should take precedent over the Companies Act. However, if they provide a lower threshold of strictness, they should not. So therefore, we are not giving a blanket exemption. It's just to say those ones who come with a stricter principle, then we allow you to, when there is a conflict, you take precedent, but not the other way around. So all in all is that that is the end of my addition to the ministers and the DDG's presentation. Thank you.
So with your permission, if I can just add a few things. To the issue around domestication of foreign companies, I think the main issue there is that this was a clear omission. It should not have happened because I think it is important for us to have that system, because what it means is that it facilitates a system where a foreign company that wants to now become a South African company does not have to re-register and create a new entity in South Africa. Because if they re-register, obviously there are other implications. In a sense, it impacts on their status as a juristic person that was before they re-register. And it might also have issues of now disposal of assets, reacquisition of their assets, and all of those, which are actually costs for those external companies or foreign companies that would actually want to come here. So it basically just reduces that process to say you can just transfer your registration from your own jurisdiction, which is a jurisdiction that recognizes and accepts that, then you can come into South Africa and just we will then recognize that and we do a process to accept you as a company in South Africa. The company does not therefore lose its juristic status. Whatever obligations that it had, they still continue, and so forth. So it doesn't change necessarily the nature of the company. Just makes the process much easier for them. In regards to the issue around the business rescue practitioner, I think it is important to apprise this committee that the concern that was raised related to the fact that because the cancellation of a contract interferes with the rights of other parties to the contract. When it happens, the business rescue practitioners should not be left with, you know, powers that are unlimited, such that it might result in some cherry-picking of certain contracts that needs to be cancelled. So I think to the extent that there may be an impact on other parties, they wanted just to make it, you know, clear that there must be a process, at least to the extent that it's cancellation. Suspension and everything else can happen within the process of business rescue, but to the extent that the business rescue process recommends cancellation of specific contracts, then it must be at least subjected to a court process. And that also is important in the area of where, for instance, the contract that is in at point might be a contract that relates to security, like where a bank has a contract, obviously, maybe a loan agreement with the company. So if you cancel those types of contracts, there might be a need to subject that to a court process. So in terms of that, I think McDonald has clarified that the issue was an issue of reading the phrasing such that people want to have the certainty that, in fact, the discretion is not a discretion that cannot be limited through a court system and cannot be limited by the common law. And the last thing I think that I just wanted to also come and add on is the issue around the independent review. The reason why there's an introduction of the independent review was to just reduce the cost on business in terms of requiring each and every company, no matter how small, no matter how private it is, to have its statements audited. And I think the consequence of this of the New Companies Act is going to be that we're going to have to look at all our other legislation that require, for instance, every company to submit, for instance, for whatever purpose, whether you're applying for finance or applying for anything, they require audited financial statements. There are some companies that, in terms of this act, they've been exempted completely from having their statements audited. Then there are those that will be required to have their statements to be independent review, which is something of a lesser form of an audit. And then there are those that, as a matter of must, they would have to have their financials audited. So the act is very clear in that, but I think the intention is to reduce the burden, but without compromising the integrity of financial reporting in the country as well. I think those are the only things that I needed to add, but I'm sure that, Minister, you would sum up a few things.
I think it's reasonably clear. I would just say that these are all matters that I think are well within the fundamental principles of the Act, and that we just need these things to be tidied up, and you know, we trust that the process and the timetable that you have, I have heard of, is something that will enable this to be completed in time for us to be able to actually implement this piece of legislation next year as planned, with the Commission in place and the Act coming into force and so on. So I think that's really it, yeah.
Thank you very much, Minister, and to the team as well. Do you wish to add anything before? Do you wish to add anything, DDG? No. Members, I pointed out earlier, before everyone was present, all the members were present, that we face a time constraint on BRRR. And we need to process this adoption before 20 past 5. Now, it is currently just 10 to 5. So, I have requested the Minister to just bear with the committee for 20 minutes. While we adjourn this part of the briefing on the company's amendment bill, you know, by all means, you're welcome to take an adjournment outside, or you can sit here, really, you know, but we would, in fact, just indicate to you when we are ready.
maybe a little bit earlier, you see.
So, members, you've had the budget review and recommendation report for some time. Well, not for some time, but for long enough to study it.
And we did ask repeatedly for recommendations. The only recommendations the Secretary received were those from the ANC. We didn't receive any other recommendations other than those that were noted in passing in the report itself as we went through our deliberations and which were extracted. There are differences in the report. The report which was handed to you and which you had the opportunity of studying did not have that intro. Will some of you recall that? I particularly pointed that out, and it was printed with the gap reflecting that. And then, of course, you will see under 1.1 something in a grey shadow there. And as I recall, from the copy you were given, you did not have concluding remarks. There was just something that said, conclusion, 12, page 12, page 13, and page, what am I looking at? Yes, and page 14. I'm sorry, I've worked on so many reports to check them this afternoon. I wasn't sure if this was the WTOEC or the Don BRRR now, but it is the BRRR. So, without further ado, I point out to you, first of all, to ask an overall question. In what you studied, were there anything you wish to raise? I'm not talking about recommendations now or conclusions. In the report you studied, is there anything you wish to raise? Yes, Honourable Ambrosini?
I wish to raise a point in limine, as we say, and for genuine guidance and as humbly as I can. I have looked at this report. I have my views. But I come from an experience which sort of burned me. So I want to have your guidance on the lay of the land. When we had the report on IPAP 2, which is perhaps the most important document that this committee engaged in, I expressed a number of views and requested them to be part of the report, which admittedly are not the views of the committee. Our libertarian views are the views I felt they to be expressed, because we need to have a diversity of views. If we all express the same views, then there is no discourse. And all those views were not registered. Now, I accept the gray. Now, Margot knows about. She received the document and she deleted them. I accept that we are in a gray area here. In respect of bills, I have the right to have a minority view in the report under the rules. And that's a must. In respect of the reports, the rules are not clear. Effectively leaves the matter to the discretion of the chairperson. Minority views may be accommodated. So I didn't go to the effort of spending hours on this before I know what the lay of the land is.
Allow me just to confer with the committee secretary for a 6 minutes. Clarity I sought, I'm not, you know, I don't know the rules that well, but I was aware that somewhere along the line it did make reference to the point you're making now. But the clarity I sought was precisely in what respect, and it is precisely related to legislation. So anything after that, this is a report itself. Now, that You know, the point you made, I'm checking with the content specialist.
Yeah.
Thank you, Honourable Turok.
No matter what the rules say, the tradition in this house has been not to have minority reports. This is going back a long time. So, since Honourable Ambrosini is relatively new, and I'm a veteran, well, the rules have been interpreted. Forgive me, I'm not against rules, but tradition is also important, and it seems to me that you may be reading the rules in a way that other people have not read it. I myself am not conversant to the rules. All I'm saying is that there is a tradition in all committees, that minorities' reports are not included. Now, if you say that the rules are there and we should observe them, I think that the chair should investigate that properly, etc. But I think the tradition is also important.
Madam Chair, I've not been clear. If I just can clarify, I've not said that I'm entitled to a minority view. I am not. You are right. I'm only entitled in respect to legislation, respect to bills. I am not. And it's because I'm not asking. I'm just asking for the lay of the land on how you wish to conduct this, whether you will allow of your own kindness and the kindness of the committee for dissenting views to be registered.
Let me put it this way, Honourable Ambrosini. The principle that you raise is very relevant. Now, if indeed that has not been rejected by the whole committee, I may have used my discretion to review that. But this was not simply rejected at the time by one party, but by the entire committee, reflecting at the time four parties. So in view of that, I am going to say no. But you are correct, and so is the Honourable Turok. Our rules, and I sit there now, so I'm beginning to learn fast on my feet, are guided not simply by what is written, by interpretation, but also by tradition and convention. But as I say, I am one of the newcomers to rules. So on the basis of the advice I have received and my own discretion as chair, I am going to indicate that I will not take account of that, seen as it was rejected by, you know, full multi-parties, as it were. So, but thank you for asking for my position on that matter. Now, members, unless there's anything else substantive to the report you received, Honourable Harris?
So I know our role is not to edit the document, but I couldn't help but find some mistakes.
No, not semantic.
Well, I mean, not semantic, but material.
Yes.
I think I submitted the edits already in writing. Didn't? Okay. There's only a couple, but is this the time to go through the report? Okay, page 5. The first... Under 4.1, industrial development, the line begins the implementation of IPAP 2, but clearly the IPAP 2 was developed or tabled, or the adjective is wrong. It wasn't implemented. It will be implemented over the next few years, but I suggest that word should be changed to tabling. And then...
Because I'm looking to you as the point is made. If you have an objection, raise your hand.
Okay.
All Mr. Harris is saying, it wasn't implemented then, it was tabled in February 2002. It is in the process of being implemented.
Okay, and then on page 7, Chair, the second to last paragraph, simply a typo. It's not to Consumer Protection Act, but rather the Consumer Protection Act, the second line of this paragraph. Then on page 12, there's a long list of key issues raised by the committee, and all of them reflect an issue raised by the committee plus an answer given by the department, except for the one called coordination with Economic Development Department, where all it does is raise the question but doesn't reflect the answer that the ministry provided to us. So I think that needs to be brought in line with the rest. And then I have a suggestion on recommendations that I...
Right, members, now we're going to now look on page one. Page one, paragraph one. Now is your time to intervene. Paragraph one. Honourable September.
Chair, could you assist me with whether this reflects what I have also asked? That the could you assist in telling us whether this reflects the request that I made? You know, the introductory that the minister made, the introductory remarks that the minister made. Is it reflected in here on this introductory part?
Would be in the body it is incorporated in the body of the report, but it's not reflected directly in the intro.
Just guide me where it is in the body, Chair.
We'll come back to that one. Paragraph two. Having said paragraph two, under economic context, the reason it, yes, Honourable Khadib.
I have 1.1, the grey.
I'm just pointing out that grey area is simply something that was put in because there was a reference made to it in the broader body of the report and added today. Right, now those are the additions, substantive additions. Then you have on page two, as required, the purpose would simply indicate this is the first time we've done this BRRR, exactly where it comes and so on. It is not a political input there, it is a technical issue. Honourable Khadib.
On the issue of the global economic meltdown, the number of jobs lost, that's the second paragraph.
Yeah.
I think the numbers are wrong there, because by all statistics South Africa indicated more than 800,000 jobs were lost because of the economic meltdown.
That was part of the old report, but it does, in our clarification, which we did seek on this over the weekend, that is only the jobs lost in respect of those sectors, and not the entire, in these sectors. And I think the bigger figure is 600 and something. All right, we're now simply going towards the end. This is the additions to what you had before. And we're coming very close to the area that you made a reference to, Honourable Harris, but we won't deal with that immediately now. Concluding remarks, paragraph one, the bottom of the page. These are new. Page 12, the bottom of the, I should say number seven. This arises out of our deliberations on it and comments we've made. and please continue with it on the first two lines of page 13. Not achieved, succeeded. Succeeded. Right. Is there anything you want to add, subtract? Right. Honorable Khadebe? No. All right. Page 13. It shouldn't say achieved. I'm advised it should say succeeded in raising the local content. That's the second line of the second paragraph. Other conclusions, the third paragraph. Now, you will recall that we did take a decision in principle that we wouldn't request more funds. We move on. Other conclusions. Food security, 7.1. Raise your hand if there's a problem, Honorable Khadebe.
Chairperson, I see this point 7.1 to 7.6, but I think there's a serious omission here. The issue of the steel issues which we dealt with, I think that will put more than enough time to deal with those issues. I think that they must be reflected. That's like the issue of the beneficiation of the iron ore into steel, and the creation of small steel mills throughout the country. I think it must be part of the conclusion we must arrive at. Because really we cannot have this report without that part to go through.
Members, just as a reminder, I think we're well aware of the hearings we undertook specifically in this area. And it had to do with the lack of beneficiation of the iron ore, but in particular the increasing price of steel and the cavalier manner in which ArcelorMittal had approached things, but also, of course, Kumba had played its own role and so on, and you all had the opportunity during a press briefing, all members of the part of the committee, in talking to the press at an open press briefing. And your comments were reflected in the press at the time as part and parcel of the process of those hearings. So I do propose that this is reflected upon in the report because it has not been resolved as we sit here. The problems, the impact of AMSA's unilateral decision to take on what was then interpreted as a broad-based mining company or interest has backfired. It certainly has not in the interest of the country. The price of steel remains the same, and members agreed that the pricing model itself was like a chameleon changing every few years. You'll remember they came with one model 3 years before, another model, as it suited them. And I think it should be reflected here because it is referred indirectly to in commodities and in raw materials, value adding and manufacturing itself. And there was also a reference to the fact that it was throttling the small steel producers and so on, and that we were not producing steel that could be used in all of our infrastructural development, but that we were importing such steel. So I'm looking at all members now. I know that some members were not here at the time that we did this, but it is in the reports that are there. Yes, thank you very much then, Honorable Smale.
Yes, the focus was very much on the value adding on the commodities, and I think that is essential that has actually got to come out.
Are we agreed with the principle? And I will show parties, you know, after it's adopted, because I think Mr. Hermans is going to have to go down to his office to process the report to meet the deadline. Are we in agreement? Yes. Can we then just move on to the second lot? So it's steel that would be added, and if we can then just simply ensure that we move on to 7.3 standards. You were all here when we raised that issue, the SMMEs, the fact that the ministers indicated they were aware of this and they were in part, not partnership, but they were working with the universities. It's not just the University of the Witwatersrand, it's the University of the Witwatersrand and other universities, and I think that's important. Other. And other universities. Number 7.5, the Cooperatives Amendment Bill, seeks to do that. And this bill is expected to be tabled next year and should be expedited, etc. That was the other point the committee made. 7.6, the situation with the trade missions in WTO and in countries of the South. I'm waiting to see hands up should there be any difference of opinion. The human capacity, the necessary financial resources. And then it simply refers to these are critical to ensure that South Africa's trade agenda is advanced in fora such as the WTO and other international economic structures. Acknowledgements. Recommendations. Now, some of you indicated you had recommendations to make. Yes, Honourable Khadebe?
Honourable Chairperson, on the issue of acknowledgements, I think that we must also put the former researcher of this committee, because when we dealt with the bulk of the work, he was part of that. Please, you know.
In Parliament, but it's on the NCOP side. Yes. No, I'm just indicating I thought he'd shifted across to the department.
Recommendation? I also don't see the PLO yet. I think she works tirelessly. The PLO, Parliamentarizing Officer, not the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Not that one. No. I think this is our committee, no? Please, this is our committee. That's what we want to put in. We cannot be told by who must put on it. I think the PLO has done a wonderful job, Honorable Chairperson, coordinating the work, ensuring that we get the info at the right time. I think that must also be acknowledged, please.
I think the thing is what we could acknowledge is the constructive working relationship we've developed with DTI, and in particular the Parliamentary Liaison Officer who has facilitated a lot of that. Just words to that effect. Yeah, we don't want this to look like a two-page sort of reference document. Okay, recommendations. Okay, Honourable Albert.
Madam Chair, if I may, I would just like to go back to 7.2, and it relates to our oversight visit to the Eastern Cape. And I was quite dismayed when we went to visit some of the farmers. We were assisted by the DTI and were given a tractor, but they didn't give them any other support, like getting a borehole. You know, it's like they didn't do a holistic study of the requirements of running the business, the agri-business. And the tractor might just stand there and never be used in the end. So I would suggest that DTI be encouraged to give workable, holistic business plans to people and give them, perhaps rather than a tractor, they must give them something else that might be more workable, or give them more than that to actually make sure that they are, their business works and it's sustainable. Thank you.
Are you suggesting it comes as a recommendation then and not linked to the 7 point, what was it, 7.2?
It doesn't have to be linked to 7.2. We can set it up as a separate recommendation that says the DTI must, in terms of supporting SMMEs and cooperatives, draft holistic business plans and ensure that it's implemented properly.
Well, I think that was in particular to do with rural areas, wasn't it, per se?
That's it.
Right. Can you just quickly draft, as it is, I'm going to be full of drafting with the steel stuff, because we need it now. And members, do you have any objection to being put in the recommendation? No. Right, can you get drafted, please? Yeah. Honourable Harris, you said you had a recommendation?
Yeah, I've drafted it. It's been submitted to your table, but I can read it if you like. I'm suggesting 9.3 because of the central role that IPAP2 plays in this entire department as the focus of their work. The suggestion is that 9.3 should read, the DTI must provide the committee with a schedule of updates on the implementation and impacts of IPAP2 and table these updates in line with this schedule.
I saw it somewhere, not word for word at all, but this issue of updates.
There is a reference.
Oh, no. It's an IPAP 2. Sorry. I've just read it somewhere, you see. So.
I think it's important enough that it should be reflected here, because we need the department to report back to us regularly. We need to know when they're going to report back, and then they need to report back at their time.
I thought I read it in this report to do with the 6 months report.
Where
is that it's one?
It's on page.
Now we can put it as a recommendation,
aren't it? It's there, but to my mind, we should make.
No. I'm not suggesting you should. Where is it currently? Honourable Khadebi, I think you actually made this reference earlier. Where is it? It's a reference to the 6 months. Where is it?
Yeah, Honourable Chairperson, I think that there was, the minister was supposed, from the annual report, the minister indicated that it was supposed to report on the 6 months, the first 6 months. Yeah. But I think that what Honourable Harris is saying, that we must put it in black and white as a recommendation that this will, that one must, although it is there in the IPAP report.
All right.
That it should be here under recommendations. Are we agreed? Right. We, Honourable Whip, Honourable Khadebe, just so that we can make some progress here, can I ask you from here, where is it? To ask you to quickly draft the steel one, and then we can go with it, okay? No, under the trade, it's under the trade, it's under Burr on page 4. If you look at page 4, point 4, can you see that? In the middle, it says, the committee welcomed the confirmation on the tabling of the 6 month IPAP 2 impact report, as well as the progress on the new procurement, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't indicate when. Where? In shortly. So that, and shortly, we didn't know what shortly meant. But shortly could have meant this year or next year. So that was the problem. In the new year, in 2011. But you see, if you've already been told that, how do we just change the one that we've got with Tim to ensure that there's no clash, but simply an underpinning? Does it underpin what was said there then? Yeah. No problem? We're going to move before we lose too many committee members. Yes, Honourable Hap?
Yeah, I think this was distributed last time, but we got a single page entitled Key Issues on BRRR Recommendations, and it begins non-compliance. I don't know who drafted this or where it comes from, but I think some of these issues, particularly the last one, should probably be reflected in the recommendations.
Give it to me. It was actually the researcher who made these points arising out of our discussion. Oh, yes, that was the researcher and myself. I think we were so busy that day. Remember the feeling.
Some very good points on that page.
Right. There's a lack of expenditure on the incentive scheme. Do you remember that issue? Honourable Kadirbi, on the incentive schemes, Honourable September, everyone listening, Honourable Ambrosini, out of 80 projects targeted in 2010, only 6 were implemented, and this compromised government priorities, etc., etc. So, we need a recommendation linking the incentive schemes to the accelerated implementation on the IPAP too, because that's exactly what it's saying. The other one was the grants, which we have got on the subsidies, the investment program, and the unauthorized, which is reflected in the report broadly, and the TISA. Does anyone want to say anything on TISA there? The main division was shifted to TISA, but that was in terms of the PFMA. You all received this, and none of you have since referred to it except Honourable Harris. The points are useful. We're now going to close. We now have 6 recommendations. The one recommendation in terms of the assistance provided to SMMEs and cooperatives by DTI, the department must ensure that holistic business plans are drafted and implemented so as to inhibit, so as to prevent, I think we'd rather say, yeah, people with all these inhibitions may come forward, so as to prevent the provision of piecemeal and unsustainable assistance. Okay. We've got the one on steel. We've got that one. And we've got one from Honourable Harris and one from Honourable Kadirbi. And that's it. And the ones you've got. And the incentives are, do we agree on putting something on the incentives linked to IPAP 2? I'm asking everyone. Any objections? No. Right. The only one that I know of that you raised repeatedly and is not here is development finance. And when I asked the parliamentary liaison officer just to check on certain things, through IPAP, development finance still falls under us in respect of IPAP. But it does fall under EC, the Economic Development Department. So I wondered if we should make it as a recommendation, as it in fact is covered by EDD. Honourable Khadir.
Honourable Chair, I think that we must give them that space to operate. You know? I think let's put it on their side, because those companies belong to them, like ITC. Yeah.
So that was the peace offering, was it? Fine. I want to thank the committee for the work it's done. What I require now is for someone to propose the adoption of the committee report. The committee report on the budget review and recommendations for the period 2009 to 2010. I'm required now to read the Steele one for the purposes of following procedure, but I think I'll ask the whip to read it for us.
All right, Chair. On the issue of Steele, I say that the DTI must conclude the work of the interdepartmental task team, which was set up to dealing with the uncompetitive behavior of the steel industry pricing. The committee further recommends that there and other commodities be beneficiated and the small steel mills be supported.
It's coming up now. Can I now have someone to propose adoption of the committee of the budget review and recommendation report of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry for 2009-2010 financial year, dated the 15th. Can't be the
16th. And I want to be very fraudulent if you can put 15.
The 16th, 2010.
Yeah.
Is there a mover? Honourable Kwabasa moves. Is it seconded? Honourable Harris seconds it. Thank you. And I
procedure, please.
But can I hasten to add, we won't be the last ones to pass our BRR RRR next year. We'll be among the first batch.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, you need to put the motion to the.
But I have indicated to the powers that be. It's because of the large volume of work and also the application of members to their work and deliberations that are not cosmetic. Right.
To the point of order, you put there's been a mover, a seconder, you haven't put the report to the committee.
I think I have, but perhaps you're better informed than I am.
Well, I haven't seen any voting. I haven't seen anyone calling for a vote. For a vote on the committee. On
you
the
don't vote on the report.
Well, I like my objection to be recorded.
Right,
that I'm entitled to.
No. Well, look, I'll be quite honest. I'm not as well informed as you are on this procedure. I have to state that publicly. So, the committee secretary has advised me that this will be in the minutes of this meeting, yes. Thank you. Honourable September?
Chair, may I just inquire, the separate page that was given here, is that automatically into the recommendation?
This was part of what was handed out on Thursday, yes. I'm not sure if you were present all the time.
There's a document there that says September on it. I'm not sure if it was handed. I don't think it was handed out on Thursday.
Oh, I... I have just been advised here, I haven't seen this directly to study, that this was incorporated into the report. But if you... No, it hasn't been, because it was forwarded only after the report was copied. I'm not sure when it was sent to the committee secretary.
I hear you, Chair. I'm asking a very simple question. Is it been considered in this meeting here, yes or no? Whether it was before, after, yesterday, this morning, whatever. Why was it handed out?
No, it isn't, but I think the point would have been to raise this when we were proposing and adopting the report, to raise an objection. Because
you can, the secretary is sitting next to you, so let's not fool each other here. If we don't want to include it, it is fine. You've asked for additions, whether you got it a minute before the meeting or not, it doesn't matter. But quite frankly, I won't send recommendations again.
I think the thing is, we were calling for recommendations and I never received them. Because all the recommendations...
The secretary is sitting next to you.
to extend this, I regret, because the fact is I didn't receive them and all recommendations have to be read out. Honourable Khadebe?
Honourable Chairperson, to help me throw out here, where were these recommendations? Where did the Secretary receive these recommendations? The Secretary of the committee?
I say we're now extending this. The Secretary says then it should have been moved the same as everyone else moved them. Everyone else moved recommendations. I do regret this particular incident because it was beyond my control. I wasn't aware of it. I'm sorry.
It is in your control now.
I'm facing a deadline. It's 8:30. Had I done it, had it been incorporated before, I would have been able to deal with it. We had passed the report. We've passed the report, you see. Unless you want, I mean, I can't withdraw it now. Honourable Khadebe?
Honourable Chair, I respect your ruling, but when you look at this, the report has already been adopted. But I think that the Secretary can file this, because even next year, I think the nature of this input here is of the long-term duration. Even in the next year, BRR, these things will still be relevant. So, but it's very unfortunate that the report has been passed, had been adopted now. But let the Secretary file it so that we can use it as reference material when we go next year. Thank you.
As I said, I certainly apologize, but it certainly didn't come to my attention as such. Thank you. So you see, Honourable Ambrosini, these things happen to all of us. If I can just point that out. I mean, not that should be setting any precedence. No, it's not intended to set a precedent. Now we're going to carry on. Sorry, Minister, do move ahead. It's what you call internal matters. We're going to resume with the company's briefing. Lambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just for clarity on my own, this bill has been put to us as a rectification bill. Correctly, the Minister pointed out that it's an amendment bill because there is no such a thing as a rectification bill. Every time we amend a bill, I mean, we rectify what was decided before. So it is a bill with the stature of a bill before us, introduced by the Minister, and we are seized with it, as we would with any other bill. So my first reaction would be that we must hold public hearings and process this bill as we would in respect of any other bill. And the reason for that is that we received submissions from a number of stakeholders already in respect of this bill, asking for additional rectification, pointing to problems with this bill at the technical level, over and beyond those which the department has identified and chosen to correct. I don't know whether they're right or whether they're wrong. The only way for us to determine whether they're right or whether they're wrong is to hear them, and especially there is the South African Association of Chartered Accountants, but there are three or four of them that have been circulated. And so it's part of our job and a plea that that be done. And again, this Parliament has got, understand now, 70% of its members who were not members in 2008. So we are a new Parliament seized with this bill. We are not going to go back to the Company Act, perhaps for many other years, perhaps not as many as from 1973, but it is a cherry at which we now have the opportunity of giving a bite. There are an additional couple of problems, and the Minister has been very clear in talking about the framework of the Act or the structure of the Act, but the structure of the Act in comparative terms, and the DDG made reference to international standards, is, for lack of a better word, old. It's old in many respects, and it's got many unique South African features which were justified during within the logic of apartheid, but need at least to be retested. And we have received submissions, for instance, the registration of shares. I don't know of any other country in the world where there is a public registry of shares. Perhaps there are some, but not the one I have dealt with. So these are some of the issues. And my comment, perhaps, in front of the Minister for you, Madam Chairman, is to ensure that this bill receives the fair chance like any other bill and is not rushed through in Parliament, as if it were not a bill of importance, and we have the opportunity of applying our mind as we would in respect of any other bill.
Yes, Honourable Member Sini, I did mention your name, and then, of course, I did ask you to go ahead. But are there any other questions, please? Honourable Harris, let's just get Honourable Albert. Honourable Harris, Albert.
Yes, Honourable Njikalana. I'm looking around for me. That's it, then. Right, do go ahead in that order.
Thanks, Chair. I apologize in advance if my questions overlap into the actual base act, but I'm quite new to this, and I would appreciate the clarity anyway. The issue around the business rescue practitioners, I understand the intention is to prevent companies from collapsing that don't need to, and hence these practitioners can now suspend an obligation. But obviously that comes with a cost to the creditors or the other agents on the other side of the transaction. Now, the amendment clearly tries to clarify how that process can happen, but one of the things it does is, I think, defer the decision to the court. What about the legal burden of this? If our courts are having to assess all of these suspensions of obligations, have we factored in that cost? My second question is I understand there was an issue around a conflict between the Act and the shareholders' agreement, and there's apparently a grace period for 2 years where shareholder agreements would be allowed to be in apparent contradiction of the Act, and then afterwards the shareholders' agreement would have to be subservient to the Act. Is that covered in the amendment, and is there any need for it to have been? Thirdly, the issue around the foreign companies. As I understand it right now, a foreign company could hold a meeting in South Africa, they could open a bank account, they could perhaps have security listed here, and that those things wouldn't comprise conducting business in South Africa for the purposes of the Act. But isn't that actually discriminatory against South African companies? Because as a South African, if you hold meetings, open bank accounts, and perhaps hold security, would you then not, as a South African company, need to register as a company, whereas as a foreign company, you would be allowed to do that without registering? And then lastly, I understand there was an issue between or with the way that many companies currently are technically insolvent in South Africa, but commercially solvent, and they operate like that under the current laws. The new Act, as I understand it, would be a contravention of the Act, and should that not have been amended in this bill? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. There's some questions to elucidate some of these amendments. On page 17, regarding conversion of par value shares, just want clarification: when a company is sold, how will they deal with the par value issue? Well, let's say a company wants to be sold on par value basis. Will the company directors, shareholders, just agree that that will be the price, or do they have to go through some sort of valuation process? mainly on empowering the minister to regulate public offerings. I'd just like to understand the rationale for the minister to regulate public offerings as such. Also in respect or against the background of the public, the IPOs that have been taking place the last couple of years, and that has created a lot of problems in the marketplace because of flotations that was out of sync of the market valuations. Then void and voidable resolutions. Last bullet point, you said the bill amends the provisions to provide clarity in terms of contracts that are voidable after the court of law has so ordered. But what about void contract itself? How do you deal with void contracts? Is void contracts or are void contracts defined as such? And you say in bullet point two that you make it was unclear which contracts are void and voidable in terms, as the terms mean different things. And the clarity was brought about voidable contract. What about the void contract itself? And then last question, page 20, last bullet point. Can you just explain to me regarding recommendations for a general exemption for all laws relating to financial tax, without a proper assessment being undertaken or the applications was not agreed to? Can you just explain exactly what the background to this, please? Thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Chair. My question is regarding the independent review. It's been some time since we have handled this piece of legislation. But I would just like to get a little bit of an illustration what would be regarded as an independent review. Who would be doing that exactly? And with regards to the licensing of the business rescue practitioners, a reference there is made that the companies and the IP commission with license, those people are not subjected to a regulated authority. What comes in mind is that what role would SANAP play here? Is it outside or within that contingent of regulated authorities? Lastly, MSMA is being included, but I see in one slide here references that MFMA is a provincial version of PFMA. I thought it was a municipal version. Actually, PFMA is also applicable to the at provincial level. However, just as a matter of general comment, I must commend the department for having picked up these areas, having gone through having experienced the process of the comprehensive surgical work of the Companies Act. It was really massive. In fact, at times we would comment that we definitely would pick up a couple of teething problems, if I can call them, down the line. We have been used to joke that we have just reduced the 300-page act to 225 or 226. So obviously this would come, but I trust and hope, you know, after the amendment, once again, the department would just, for the benefit of those members who have been exposed to this act now, would take some time to just take us through, particularly the key principles of the act. Thanks, sir.
Okay, I'm going to be brief. Just on page 17, bullet point number 3, just a clarification on the tax issue on the par value shares and the certain period that it's got to pay on. But the second, the it's the second part that actually poses a question mark for me, is that it that it's the loss of voting rights that might occur, and what actually happens to companies that because we're talking about a certain period, and a certain period is not a definite period, and I actually need to understand what the effect is to those companies that don't comply with a certain period or the definite period, and why didn't we put a definite period in this? Thank you.
Right. I'm just also checking with the minister. I know about your earlier point, and clearly the minister will just be popping out in a few minutes. Over to yourselves.
Okay. Let me just make a couple of points. I think a lot of the points are for the much more for the team. I just want to say that this is an amendment bill passing through Parliament through the regular procedures of Parliament. But I think that. What is important is the long title of the bill, which covers its ambit. And this says that the object of the bill is to amend the Companies Act 2008 so as to effect certain legal, technical, and grammatical amendments in order to ensure the proper application and administration of the principal act subsequent to its commencement, to correct certain errors resulting in inconsistency and ambiguity in the principal act, to establish a proper foundation for certain necessary regulations, to continue the mechanisms established under Article 335 of the Companies Act 1973, which allows for the transfer of registration of foreign companies to the jurisdiction of the Republic, and to provide for matters connected therein. That's the scope of the bill, and I think of any engagement with it. I mean, it's up to the committee to decide how it wants to proceed with the bill, but I think that... we would anticipate that there will be lots of people that will want to will approach the committee, and I'm sure the committee will then have to apply its mind as to how it deals with that, and there may be debates, as Honourable Ambrosini is saying, as to whether what's covered is sufficient and so on and so forth. I think the only appeal I was making is that I think that we are going to possibly find that there will be an attempt in some cases to actually enter into the terrain of some of the matters that were dealt in the substance of the bill, and I think that that's not covered by the long title, and I think that it's also something that I just think the committee needs to be vigilant about when it processes the bill. So it is an amendment bill, as an ordinary amendment bill, but subject to that long title. Let me just a couple of the other questions very quickly. I mean, I think that the question of the business rescue process and the business rescue practitioners. I mean, right now, even on judicial management, when you have that, you suspend the action of the creditors. That's what you do. Creditors can't come in and attach all the assets and take it. You know, that's what it is. And I think what's been said here in the amendment is that we're saying that most of the of all of that will continue to be covered as it's specified in the bill. All we say is that where it comes to the cancellation of a contract, cancellation, not suspension. And I think that's the fundamental point about that's been dealt with in here. So just to give a degree of comfort to those who thought that business rescue practitioners could walk in willy-nilly, cancel any contract. In fact, they can't. They've got to have all kinds of grounds to do that that the contract was a contract which was, in some ways, let me just use the phrase, odious. That it imposed unreasonable conditions. Those are the only terms under which they could cancel anyway. But they can't do it willy-nilly. They have to do it with reference to the court. So I don't think it's every single decision of the business rescue practitioner is going to the court. It's just the ones that imply the most drastic action, i.e. cancelling the contract. I think that a number of the other questions, I think I'll leave those to the team. I think that just to say that I think these are the sort of things we need to point out. I don't believe that the conditions under which foreign companies can operate, if you want to put that in some way, without registration. I don't think that discriminates against South African companies, but we have to just look at that and get an answer from the team. So let me just hand over then to the DDG.
Thank you, Minister. I think the team here will respond to the questions, and I'll just deal with the ones that they have not dealt with.
No, thanks. I will share the points with my colleagues. Let me deal with the first one. The first one I think as a comment, really, from Honorable Ambrosini. I hope I pronounced it well. To say, let's go to the public hearing. That's where we will hear a lot of things. And I think the days are scheduled by Parliament itself to say when are the public hearings. That's when we will hear a lot of issues. But as the Minister said, there may be other people who want to open policy debates which are closed. That one we cannot preempt, but I think there will be public hearing as a normal process. The issue of business rescue practitioners, the creditors, legal costs for referral, Honorable Harris, if I'm not mistaken. Some of them I'm not used to them, sorry to mention by name. I think in this area, this business risk group practitioner is a sort of a judicial officer in terms of the statutory provision. And therefore, when he or she suspend terminate contracts, he is the one who has to apply to court, to go to court, instead of shifting the burden to the creditors and the like to say, you pay 1, 2, 3. It will be the person who wants to invoke that provision of saying, I want to cancel this, and therefore let's go and confirm it to court. So if I had the question where cost will not go to the creditors, whatever, it will be borne by that statutory created body. That is how I can respond to it. In the area of shareholder agreements, again, the 2 years transitional period, it is here, it is dealt with here, but the gist of it is to say they will be valid. And then a transitional period, say 3 years, what is it, article, what is it, clause 10, all right? So within that period of 2 years, it will be valid. But beyond that period, then that's where the problem starts. That's how I'm responding to it, to say there is a transitional period of 2 years, and then it is valid. And then thereafter, you need to close and then comply with the act going forward. And then the issue of technical insolvency and commercial insolvent, the two terms, I will club them together. We debated this issue to say, really, there's a difference of being a technical insolvent and being really at a liquidation. We are not dealing with liquidation here. We are dealing with somebody who has got money and everything. However, that person may have a problem of activating the business in so much that the issue of circulation of money within the circulation of money, so much that now you can be able to pay a third party is a problem. Here is an example. A farmer has got 10 billion assets and money combined, but is owing 1 million, only 1 million. But because of some administrative purposes, then is it fair to go and liquidate that farmer who has 10 billion assets and money combined in order to get your 1 million? Why can't we resuscitate this farmer who is employing people, the economy is thriving, has got all the assets, and then compromise for a certain period in order to be able to settle the debts. I think that's where we are here. So that farmer, yes, is technically insolvent, but if you get somebody who can run the business well, this person within a period of 6 months can settle those debts. So I think that's what we mean by being technical insolvent. It's a good principle, I think. And then the other issue, void and voidable. I think the problem is that presentation, maybe we didn't talk about voidable. Is that the question? Voidable? Sorry.
It's actually, you say that voidable has been clarified. What contracts are voidable, but not which are void? So just clarification on the void aspect as well. Because in terms of common law, there's void contracts, obviously, but I don't know if the Companies Act provides any additional type of void contracts. Thank you.
Yes. My colleagues will help me here. But I think the rationale was to say, in reality, the Act should not say anything per se on the issue of void contract. If it is void, it is void. I think that is the rationale. So the way how it is captured in the Principal Act, people are saying it is confusing because it's confusing void and voidable. Can you separate them so that we see the difference? And then the example which I gave maybe was bad. I said, if it is a statutory rape for a five-year-old girl, the court cannot say, I think it is the agreement between the two was voidable. It is void from the onset. The court does not have to say anything. I think that was the message which I was sending. But in the area of voidable, I gave a 17.5-year-old going to university, just an example, and enter into a contract that I will settle 1, 2, 3. Then that minor say, I was young, now I'm withdrawing that consent. I didn't give consent because I'm young. I'm saying that one needs to be debated. The court say, I am pronouncing now. It's a voidable one, and therefore you are bound. So here we are saying, the reading part of it, of the act, it was not separating the two. So the bill wants to clarify them. As to whether there is enough clarity, I think it's for the debate in this house to say it is couched well. But that's how I wanted to separate them. My colleague may come in here. In the area of independent review, Honorable if I'm not mistaken, who should conduct it and the like. I think the Act is saying some people will, maybe you belong to a professional body, you are regulated, you can apply, can be accredited, all those issues. Then you can do that. However, there are those people who have been maybe rescuing companies and then who do not belong to a professional body, as an example. Rescuing mines, airlines, and the like, there are those people, but they don't belong to a professional body. What about them? So I think the bill wants to say the commission should have that power of saying on a merit, on a case-by-case basis, you can apply, and then you prove yourself to say, I have dealt with this mine, I resuscitated this and that, but I don't belong to any professional body. So who am I? Then they should have a discretion, the commission, to license that person to say you can perform such. The issue of fairness, I will tone down. I understand where the honorable member is moving to, as to whether it will be in the equation. No, I don't want to say anything as for now. That one of the provincial, yes, we have got three tiers of government, the provinces and the national government. For the purposes of PFMA, they are treated at the same par. But the municipalities, they are outside of the equation, so we are bringing them.
their legislation in here. Yeah, so this one is an error. That is the concession. It's an error to say which is a provincial version of the PSMA. It's a municipal one. We agree that. The tax issues, par value, indefinite. Yes, I think in that area, the others will come to these issues, and then may I allow the other people to. Also, the issue which I said, if they are not clearly stated, they can redo it, no problem. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My colleague has seemed to answer quite a bit of them. I'll just jump in quickly with some of them. The one that the Honorable Njikalana mentioned about what would be regarded as independent review. Independent review is a standard which has been defined in international financial reporting standards and accordingly have been put out in terms of engagement, assurance engagement, like an audit. An audit is an assurance engagement whereby the auditor will go in and look at the processes, the finances, and all the mechanisms of the company and to see if they are functioning accordingly in terms of an international standard as regards audit. In terms of independent review, it is a lesser standard of assurance which is provided in terms of what will be looked at in terms of the process of a company. Let me give you a small example. For example, an auditor will go in and say, let me look at your process in terms of how you record your stock, for example, and you have to go through and show him exactly how it is done in terms of a standard that is put out. In terms of independent review, it will simply be an asking of a question, do you have a standard and what standard do you apply? They won't have to be walked through the process of determining what is actually within the standard and what is determined within the full assurance of that particular standard accordingly. We'll be doing it accordingly. The way that we have envisaged is that because we're trying to lessen the burden, which also is related to the cost burden, we're seeing accountants accordingly doing it. And if you look at one of the amendments that we did in terms of the amending of a definition, we redefine exactly what the definition of an audit is by removing the aspect of a relation towards a review. So we looked at the whole aspect of changing the whole cycle of the assurance being given only by auditors, but lowering it towards an accounting standard in terms of lowering of the cost, as well as lowering the whole time it takes in order to give that particular assurance accordingly in terms of that.
Thank you, Chair. The question about the shareholder's agreement for a period of 2 years that it may continue to run as it is, that the Act is now being amended by Clause 118 of this bill, in terms of which it then provides that any shareholder's agreement can continue to exist for a period of 2 years, even if it's in conflict with the Act. After that, it will continue to exist only to the extent that it's not in conflict. So the parts of the shareholders' agreement that are in conflict will then not have any force in terms of that agreement. So only the parts that are in harmony with the Act will continue to be of force. But the parties will have sufficient time within the two-year period to clarify their whole position between themselves. And that's the intention of the amendment. The question about the external company being allowed to open banking accounts, and that could be regarded as discriminatory against South African companies. I don't think that's quite the case. I think what the situation is, the moment a South African company is registered, it has the right to open banking accounts anywhere in the country, and for that matter also across the borders. Depending on what legislation is prevalent in the other countries. Another question that was raised was whether the par value shares will have to be reconsidered when properties, for instance, sold. The par value is just a nominal value attached to the shares. The real value of any par value share is determined by adding a premium to that par value to arrive at the actual asset value of that share. So you've got to determine the real asset value of a share by adding a certain amount of premium to get to the serial intrinsic value. Let's see if there's anything else that I still need to.
Chair, through you, I just would touch on just two that I think may not have been covered sufficiently. I think the honourable member requested the background to the slide that talks to the general exemption for financial sector legislation that we didn't agree to. I think as we went through this process of rectification, a lot of people brought a number of things on the table to say, you know, this should have been included under the Section 5.4, where a piece of legislation will take precedence over the Companies Act. And one of the submissions was that we must put in that section all financial sector legislation, and as well as the tax legislation. And we have had a discussion around that, and to say that it is not a proper principle to exempt legislation or to give it precedence over the other if you haven't done a proper audit and a proper assessment. All of the legislation that were proposed in the Companies Act for inclusion, so that they can prevail over the Companies Act in case of conflict, those pieces we have done a proper and thorough audit before we came here through the corporate law reform process, before we even came to presenting the policy to cabinet. So we think that as a matter of principle, I think we will be misguided, and we will also be misleading Parliament if we were to come with legislation which has not been properly audited for inclusion. But I think one thing that is important is that over the implementation of this legislation, should it arise, you know, in the course that this legislation, maybe a proper audit has been done that requires to be put in that similar standing, there's still an opportunity when the regular reviews that Parliament would do on its laws that they can include those. But at this point, we didn't think that this process was appropriate for that proposal. The other aspect that I thought I should just respond to is just in terms of the phasing out of the par value shares. Schedule 5 of the Companies Act right now, the new Companies Act, it does provide for the two ministers, the Minister of Finance and Minister of Trade and Industry, to agree on a mechanism that will facilitate that, and that will then be spelled out in the regulations, which will then be published thereafter. So that process is there, and we have been engaging with the National Treasury in terms of when we're doing the regulations during the drafting process, as well as right now we're still engaging with them on that, and we'll be agreeing to certain things which will then be subject to the public comment as well. I mean, the public would be allowed to comment on that. But one of the key things that obviously was raised by National Treasury is really the effect of that process, that like, for instance, the loss of voting rights, that which might compel certain companies to restructure. And the restructuring might actually trigger some tax implications somewhere, the capital gains tax and all of that. So there must be an agreement in terms of a mechanism that will make this seamless, but also not to be a burden to the current shareholders of those par value shares. So it is a process that we're currently involved in. The last thing, maybe just before I get out of this area, is in regards to the audit and the independent review. I think there's always been stakeholders that have felt that we should not even be introducing a substandard. But I think what is important for this committee to at least appreciate is that an independent review is not a substandard. It is just something that is enough for a particular type of company, given its size, given its impact, and given the size of the operations, the workforce, and all of that. So it's basically not something that is substandard. But I think the impression that gets to be created is that because it's a review, therefore it's something of a lesser standard than an audit. It's not. It's just different rules for different types of companies, given their sizes and all of that. And I think that is something that we just want to express to this committee, to say we are not bringing something or the Companies Act did not bring something that makes our financial reporting, maintenance of financial statements and all of that to be substandard. We still adhere also to the financial international financial reporting standards. So this is aligned to that, and these are things that are already happening in other countries, which we have benchmarked against, and we think that there is support for this kind of direction that we are taking as a country, and that it should be supported by this committee as well. Thanks.
Our members, it would appear, the Deputy Minister is back. I may have not seen her earlier, though, so I apologize because, but do you want to comment on anything?
Right.
Members, are there not any more questions or comments? I'm looking around me on the company, because this is a briefing. I think we do understand that. We are aware that the advertisements have been posted with regard to the public hearings that the committee will embark upon, beginning in line with the rules of Parliament from the 30th of November. I think, remember, we already have agreed upon that. And as I recall, the 30th and the 1st. I'm just not sure right at the moment what these days are, but I certainly can check almost immediately, which I will do. Some of you may have a better opportunity. But it would certainly appear to be Tuesday and Wednesday. Is that correct? Now, we certainly must hold these hearings this year. What that will give us the opportunity to do then is to evaluate what we hear from the get out of the hearings and get our researchers and content analysts to just unpack some of the points so that we're able to look at a summary of these public hearings and then reflect on our different political caucuses, as it were. So that when we come back early in the new year, I will ask the committee secretary to brief you so that should we have found out, as we did in IPAP 2 and in the trade policy, that a particular sector or grouping has been overlooked in view of the target for the bill, the intention of the bill, then that provides us with a final opportunity, if I may put it that way, to call for public hearings on the day, when we return to work in the new year, as it were, which I've been assured is the 18th of January onwards for committee meetings. So I mention this now so that you are not disconcerted if you get that call. And if it can be explained, this set of public hearings that we call within the rules of Parliament is so that the committee itself can identify others it may wish to invite because they feel that this grouping or that grouping may have been overlooked. You will recall we also did that with food and IPAP and that kind of thing. And it's an important instrument that we need to make use of. So please set aside at this stage 18 and 19, but as soon as we can, we will give an idea as to what we are looking at for deliberations. And then the programming has given me an undertaking that there will be a House sitting at the end of January prior to the State of Nation Address, which does happen from time to time. And so it's possible for us to process it then. If that is not the case, then it would be after those heavy commitments, but still before March. So that just simply gives you an idea as to where we may be taking this. What I would appreciate is that during your study of the bill tables before us, should you wish to raise anything that you believe we should be pursuing as a committee, will you raise it with me, both through the committee secretary to ensure that I do get this information, and myself. I hope I've made myself absolutely clear on that point.
I don't think that we have anything further to add. It's just a pity not all members are here when some of these positions are taken, you see. And then, of course, have the need to come back and make another little input, as it were. But never mind, notwithstanding that, we wish to thank the department for briefing us. But I do see, perhaps, at this point, I don't know if the minister had wished to return to make any further. I know that he wished to leave at 6:30, that I am aware of. So it could be that he will simply return, and perhaps you can find out, Ms. Naidu. While we're waiting for that, I don't know if you've had distributed to you the WTO report. Is that distributed? Now, you do know you've had this report, so that it's actually into the archival system now. We had to retrieve it from there because it's so old. The only thing it was missing were the recommendations from yourselves. And as you know, the current DA members were not present during that study visit. And before we lose anyone else, we need to take a position. So now you have them, do you? I hope I could have got my copy as well. Oh, well, we were just simply distributing the WTO report. But, Minister, I see you have returned. We had completed our line of questioning, and we were just reiterating when the public hearings will take place and so on. But if you wish to say anything, just to close off the department's briefing.
Well, let me just say one thing, that, of course, the parliamentary process will have to be followed in all its various dimensions, and I think we expect that you will do a thorough job and so on. But I would also just urge you to bear in mind that there is the deadline that we set for the implementation, and I think that we don't want to send any further uncertainties into the marketplace. I mean, people are preparing on the basis that the new law will come into place on the 1st of April. And I think if we can just ask that you give it due priority, due attention, so that we can come up with a good product that does deliver on the expectations of the Companies Act. That, I think, would be our appeal to the committee. So that would be the last remark. I hope that the other members covered everything else, and I'm sorry I had to go out. I couldn't avoid it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Minister. We have been looking forward to receiving this bill, particularly in view of the commission, I think, is that will be established, which indeed we were briefed on last year, and of course also the new structure and where we're moving with DTI and so on. So it's one of these bills that I believe is quite critical to ensure that we do address the broader, smaller companies so that they can financially afford to continue their operations and to provide employment. And we welcome this, and we will study it. And of course, I know that you will be sending members from the department to sit in on those public hearings. That's why I mentioned those dates, but we will keep you abreast of them. So thank you very, very much. And I'm just trying to see whether we will be seeing you again, Minister, in terms of the committee this year. And probably not. I'm just looking at the situation in terms of the committee. So on behalf of the committee, we would really like to thank you for the constructive relationship we've developed between the Portfolio Committee and the Ministry and the Department, and certainly not without what one may call healthy tension, as it were, to ensure that we do exercise effective and robust oversight you know. So we're certainly not in bed with the department, which we had to make very clear in some instances, very far removed from that situation. But I think we welcome the constructive relationship and the fact that you truly have made yourself available and your deputies available, and the members of your department have usually come in full force, as it were. So thank you very much. And pleasant, I know you won't be having, as it were, too much of a festive season, but we hope you will see your family. Thank you. Right. On the committee side, now that we've released the minister and his team, as I was saying, and I mean, we are having a little bit of a problem. I'm looking at the whip here, committee whip, because we've got some valid apologies, as you know. Only thing is we're facing a quorum problem of two members. I know that Honourable Kobasa is probably at some other meeting within Parliament, I'm assuming. I'm not too sure about Honourable Tua, because he did indicate he wished to leave at 6:30. I'm not too sure. And then Honourable Ambrosini, I wasn't aware he'd left, you see, until I looked up. So he managed to leave quietly. And then Honourable Harris, of course, I am aware that he is otherwise engaged. I did get an apology there. So is there any way we could get just two members from ETC? I haven't got an apology from the IFP, so I was quite... I don't know if anyone else received it. We need 8.
Honourable Chair, I think that is the biggest challenge you have, is that the House has long time ago adjourned. So I think that is going to be very difficult to get anyone around around the presence of Parliament now. Unless you look at the study group.
Well, I wonder if we could ask both our my secretary,
yeah,
just to see what she can do,
yeah,
and as it were persuade people to join us for 5 minutes. It would be 5 minutes. You know, and if you can get to yourself, Miss Hurling, hold of Mr. Ambrosini. In fact, if you just get hold of the party office and ask them where their member is, don't refer to names, because they can send anyone. Yes.
Could I just make a proposal that we as a committee just look at the recommendations so long? So when those members come, that we actually just take a vote on that.
So, but it was important just to get those members. Now we're going to go through this. You've had this. And if you haven't looked at it, I'm sorry, but turn to page 23. Page 23. Some of this you had, and it was extracted along the way, if I could put it that way, during the previous deliberations we had, which was before your time, regrettably. And I chose our oldest reporters. So these are... I don't even know if you were present at the time, Honourable Albert, because I know you were in hospital at some point during this report. But there it is. You'll recognise some of the points made under 7, first paragraph, second paragraph, and third.
Yes, thank you. If you can just clarify for me, bullet point 7.9, there's an M with a question.
We're just on page 23. It's good to know you're a fast reader. First three pause. Okay. As I'm not seeing any hands, other conclusion 7.1. Now, page 24, 7.2. I think the word is could make, not can. 7.3, the committee noted the contribution that UNCTAD could make if developing countries. 7.4. Seven point six, as I said. 7.7. The reason that that is in grey is because they were actually contributed by specific members after the committee. Remember when we were asking you the other day for more? And of course, there they are. By the way, the parliamentary M has been removed. It's parliamentary groupings. The M just simply stood for meetings, IPM, some of you will recall, okay. But it's groupings. Some of you may even belong to focus groups of that kind of nature. I think you do, Honourable Kamala, is that correct? And I must say, they're very useful. I mean, we had the opportunity, Honourable Kamalu will confirm, to actually speak at committee meeting or during a committee meeting on certain issues, which was quite unique in some ways, I thought. All right. Now, can we then look at the grey? Do you have a problem with the grey? Can we let it move? 7.8, 7.9. Yes, someone's got a hand, Honourable Khadib.
All right, Chairperson, on the issues of acknowledgement, in particular the last part, the Chairperson thanks
but
all
But what
the
about 7.8? You were just there at the moment.
Which one? Are we not?
Well, we remember you took us back there. Okay. Oh, 8. My apologies. Yeah. Go ahead.
Chairperson, I don't know how we can put it, but I think that the delegation which went to the WCO was one of the most cohesive and effective delegations which we had. I think that one must come across the board, because what happened there, there was no party politics, whatever it might be. It was the interest of South Africa first. I think that it must be kept shutting one. I see that you do have to acknowledge, but you acknowledge that on the last sentence. But I think that cohesiveness and putting South Africa first must come at the top.
I know it's difficult for the DA to participate in that because you yourself weren't present, neither was Honourable Harris. But without putting Honourable Alberts on the spot just yet, the reality was, I think we went there as a group of South Africans, and we shared a number of the points very much. I think in particular, one of the issues we were all alarmed about as a group was the one input from the WTO person, if I could put it that way, requesting, in inverted commas now, very much, it's my alliteration and so on, that we kind of scrap what we were doing, seeing as, you know, if we didn't make money out of these things and try and grow some other crop that we could sell and make money out of. And, you know, the food security questions we raised didn't seem to change. We ought to buy what we needed. I don't know, Honourable Alberts, if you remember that point about the agriculture. And everyone was alarmed, perhaps from different perspectives, of course. What exactly did the, you know, but it seemed to be largely based on the comparative advantage reflected in economic theory and, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas I do think a lot of countries, but in particular South Africa, have supported putting food security first before addressing other issues that may arise. So I'm just mentioning that as one issue that cut across the board. The second issue that cut very much noticeably cut across was South Africa's interest in the development of its auto industry. And, you know, things like that. So there was certainly a shared approach, an identification of priority issues in the country. But apart from that, there was a strong cohesion in the group. When people did separate in their so-called spare time, of which there was very limited spare time because it was very intensive, early in the morning and late at night, it was really grueling, that's how intensive it was. People tended to ask if others would like to join them, you know, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of cohesion in the group, and I think that is what is being referred to here. But as I said, you put in a bit of a difficulty there because you weren't there. But perhaps now we'll give the Honourable Albert an opportunity to comment if he so wishes.
Madam Chair, yes, I agree. There was a whole lot of cohesion at what's about. I think because we were there in overseas circumstances, we were foreigners, so to speak. We felt more of a cohesiveness, first of all. But I think when it comes to South Africa and South Africa's place in the world trade system, we were quite adamant, including the members of the DA at that stage, that South Africa, we should think South Africa first, and we should try and find a policy space that they talked about to serve our own interest as far as we can without, you know, without breaching any of our international obligations. So I think we definitely were, despite the fact we're a multi-party delegation, we were thinking the same thing. We wanted the same outcomes, and like you said, it might be from different ideological perspectives in the end, but it was most definitely one that was focused on South Africa first, and especially with regard to the food security aspect.
So we had members of the IFP at the 11th hour had to decline due to an urgent party political commitment, and the other member, Honourable Ambrosini, was in Italy at the time. So it was, I understand, difficult to get hold of him literally the day before we left. But Kurt was there.